Jorgensen, good morning to you. Now we've got folks coming in and out, including your opposing lawyer. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court? Absolutely. My name is John Jorgensen from Lancaster County Public Defender's Office, and I'm in favor of presenting Mr. Christian Phillips on his direct appeal from the sentence that was imposed by the Lancaster County District Court for the violation of the sex offender registration. Now, in my brief, I submitted primarily two main errors. First being as to whether or not incarceration should have been imposed in the first place. I'm willing to submit that particular issue on my brief unless there's any other questions concerning whether or not incarceration was appropriate as opposed to probation. I'd like to focus my conversation with the court here today in regards to the second assignment of error, in regards to the post-release supervision conditions that were imposed upon the appellant in this particular matter. And in my brief, I outlined a litany of those conditions which are being challenged on appeal, and I'd primarily like to start with talking about the computer or the internet conditions that I identified in my brief that are being challenged on the present appeal.
Were any of the arguments that are made in your brief presented to the sentencing court?
No, they were not.
Is that significant?
Well, it can be, depending on how the court wants to handle this. Now, the court certainly has the option of turning every sentencing hearing into an hour and a half long hearing where each and every litigant is being required to object to what in some circumstances can be 6-7 pages worth of do's and don'ts that are being outlined under post-release supervision. So you have that particular problem. You also have the additional burden that those particular provisions are not provided to a litigant prior to the sentencing hearing, so they're provided no advance notice as regards to what those particular sentences or post-release conditions might be. Now, some of them are granted going to be something boilerplate, so you can expect that the court may look to impose fees or that there may be some other curfew, or you're going to have a general idea of the boilerplate ones, but most litigants are going to walk in and have absolutely no idea as to what is going to be imposed. And I think that's an unreasonable burden being placed on a litigant to sit there and say that this is what they have to do and go through that whole process. And you also have to consider that these conditions are a sentence. If someone doesn't abide by these particular things, then they are incarcerated. It's an extension of the sentence that's being imposed. And just like we don't require a litigant to sit there and say, I object to getting 20 to 30 years in prison in order to perfect an appeal to review that determination as to the appropriateness of the 25 to 30 years or whatever the term of imprisonment might be, so too would it be unreasonable to expect a litigant to, on the cuff, object to the litany of those particular things.
And is this court at some disadvantage if we haven't had a trial court deliberate and make some determination about these issues before it comes to us?
No, I think the court can look at these conditions and make a determination as to the appropriateness of these particular conditions. I think the court certainly can. And I think that the lower courts, the district courts, would greatly benefit from having that across the state, because when they implemented the changes under 605 and created this beast of a process of post-release supervision, you were getting wide and varied results of it. What is imposed as a regular course in Lancaster County is not going to be the same as what's regularly imposed in Cherry County or other counties across the state.
Is that true also of probation normally? Old-fashioned probation?
Well, it may or it may not, but that's the problem. This is not exactly probation. This is not quite parole. This is amalgamation of parole and probation of sorts. And so that's why I think it really requires an exceptional review that directs from this court to the lower court. This is what needs to be done, and that the district courts need to do an exacting review before they implement these various boilerplate type of conditions, including things like prohibiting someone from being able to use the internet, or prohibiting someone from being able to use the computer, or being required to test 3 times a week.
Does the legislation suggest that this is more like probation than parole?
Well, you can read into that because of the enabling language that they put forth in there to say that if it's permitted under probation, then conditions would be structure for the post-release supervision, that's how they enacted the provision. So I suppose in theory you can say that this is akin to probation. However, it's not, because if there is a failure to comply with these post-release supervision conditions, the person is incarcerated, and so it's not a submit for resentencing and a brand new determination as to the fitness or appropriate of a sentence that might be imposed. They're incarcerated, and then
What's the significance of 29-22-62-2 with the list of 20 conditions?
What is the significance
of that? I mean, does this tell you these things are possible, as opposed to surprising the defendant at the sentencing?
I think it provides some notice, certainly, that individuals could be, in theory, subjected to various terms and conditions. The real problem is when you get to that subsection R, the reasonably related catch-all type provision, and then all of these other things filtering into, well, it's reasonably related, reasonably related, reasonably related, when oftentimes it may very well not be reasonably related, like we have in this particular case where you have drug testing 3 times a week for a person that doesn't have a drug problem, where you have someone who's restricted from being able to use the internet, being able to use a computer in the modern day, and not being able to even tune in to watch the live oral arguments for their counsel arguing before the Supreme Court, not able to view that, a litigant not being able to participate in that. The political process.
Counsel, you keep saying your client can't use the internet. It actually reads, shall not use the internet for any reason unless given advance permission by the supervising officer. So your client can use the internet. They just want to supervise it for obvious reasons. I mean, they don't want your client viewing pornographic material, do they?
Well, you have problems with what does pornographic material mean, but besides that point, you're also mischaracterizing in some regards the thought that an individual is going to be able to have ready and immediate access to their probation officer to obtain permission for using that particular device.
Isn't that the price you pay for getting convicted of a felony?
No, I don't think you completely throw away your right to participate in the political process just because you committed a crime. I think it is an unreasonable burden to place upon an individual to say
what does this have to do with participating in the political process?
Well, he's not able to use his computer or access the internet without prior restraint, and then when he does use it, it is involved with monitoring and tracking, and that is a cloud being placed upon that particular use. Might not want to go to this particular website because his probation officer is a Republican, he's a Democrat, or vice versa. You'd have a whole host of different problems with the monitoring and the tracking of internet activity. So there's a real and distinct problem with relying upon a probation officer to enforce what is appropriate, what is not appropriate for an individual, and especially in this particular case because it's not even reasonably related to the underlying offense. A computer was not involved in the underlying sex offense. A computer was not involved in regards to the violation of the Sex Offender Registration Act. There is no indication that it had served any need. It does not fill any rehabilitative need. It does not serve to address any punitive need. So it's not even reasonably related under that sub R, I believe, provision of what's permitted.
Before your time is up, what would you like us, if we disagreed with the trial court as to the number of times drug testing should be performed? What do you want from this court?
I would ask that the court do one of two things. One, individually review the appropriateness of each and every condition that's being challenged on appeal. Because in this particular case, there was not that exact interview done by the district court. What you can see here is that there was a blanket imposition of various terms because you're a sex offender, here's all the things that all the sex offenders are going to have to do. Since that exacting review wasn't done by the district court, we're asking this court to do this.
How do we know the exacting review wasn't done by the district court? Didn't the district court draft the order that imposed all of this?
Because of all the overwhelming provisions that are not even...
Well, that's a circular argument.
I don't think it's circular at all. You're talking about why can we tell that there wasn't that exacting review, because you can look at the number of things that aren't applicable to this individual. There weren't, if they were applicable, there'd be a reason for them. There's no reason for
them. We would know the court's reasoning if you had raised the issue in the trial court, wouldn't we?
Well, potentially. again, you're coming back to the same problem as to whether or not, you know, you're going to expect someone to be able to respond to something on the cuff, and the pages and pages of conditions that are involved in this particular case, I think it places an unreasonable burden on the
litigant. Isn't the premise of your argument, it wasn't an issue at the time of the original offense, therefore it will be never an issue in his future release? Isn't that the understated premise?
I'm out of my time.
You can answer.
Thank you. I guess, would be the answer to the question. Yes, it would be a notion that because a computer was not involved, and the use of internet was not involved in the underlying sex offense, it was not involved in the failure to register, that yes, it is inappropriate to impose any restrictions on his ability to use a computer because it does not involve any rational relationship back to penological needs, rehabilitative needs, or any needs whatsoever. It's unnecessary conditioning. He's being unduly punished because he's a sex offender.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Klein, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice. I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state in this matter. I think there are a couple of things that we should, I think, establish as a groundwork, and then we can go on to the arguments from there. Post-release supervision is a form of probation by statute. 292246 sub 4 specifically says probation includes post-release supervision. So it is simply a flavor of probation. The terms of probation are specifically set out by statute in 292262, and there are, I think, 26 or some odd of them. And those are the conditions that a probationer may be subject to. And my understanding is that those are the only conditions that a probationer may be subject to. Therefore, you should assume when you are going in for sentencing that any or all of those may be imposed upon you. And the district court, in fact, in this case, imposed every single condition it could because of the nature of this particular defendant who was made perfectly well aware at the time of his sentencing for the sexual offense, which made him subject to SORA. He was well aware of his obligations under SORA, and he did absolutely nothing to comply with them. And in fact, frankly, did his best to not comply with them. And the court looked at those and determined that this guy needs to be made to toe the line because he is doing nothing to live a law-abiding life, which is the ultimate goal of post-release supervision, is to make him live a law-abiding life by imposing a number of terms and conditions which, frankly, the average citizen is under an obligation to abide by.
Well, let's, I don't know, even though this is a hypothetical, if you are someone who has been sentenced to one of these post-release supervision orders, when is the right time to appeal, and what should be the procedural process for handling these kinds of appeals?
It seems to me that because you are at least on notice what the conditions may or will be, they are set out by statute, that you should be prepared to object at the time that those are imposed, that those are unreasonable or you don't like them or whatever your complaint about them is at the time of sentencing.
So the sentence is a final order appealable?
Yes. Yes, and it seems to me like any other objection to whatever occurs during the course of the trial or the sentencing, you need to apprise the court that you think there's an issue with that and give that lower court a chance to address or correct that error before you take it up and have the appellate courts address it. I don't think that that should be any different than any other particular objection.
So, for example, in this case, what if this court decided that there is nothing in this record that the defendant has a drug problem, a substance problem at all, and he has to be tested 3 times a week. What if we decide the test should only be once a week? What are we to do with that? Do we send it back to the trial court, or do we enter some new order? What's the process here?
It would be, I suppose, a modification of the sentencing order, which I think you would probably be at liberty to do, but I think if that's going to be done, then you're going to be doing that in every single case in which post-release supervision is imposed. The whole point of our probationary statutes is to give the discretion to the district court to look at a particular individual and decide based on what it sees about this particular person as to what it's going to take to make this person live a law-abiding life. And that's our standard.
There is some language in the statutes, is there not, about reasonably related conditions? And what are we supposed to do with that?
Again, I think that's committed to the discretion of the district court. What is reasonably related to making him live a law-abiding life, especially when you've got somebody like this guy who has done exactly nothing to comply with his SORA requirements, which are frankly excruciatingly simple. Go to the sheriff, tell him I'm living at 123 Sesame Street, bye. And he didn't do that. He absolutely did not do that. In fact, he went to extremes. He gave them a false address. He went and got an ID card with an address, who knows whether it was real or not, and never bothered to make his way to the sheriff's office to give them that same address.
But how are the terms and conditions of this post-release supervision related, reasonably related to ensuring that he registers?
It isn't reasonably relating to whether or not he registers. It's reasonably related to him living a law-abiding life. And that means basically just doing what Joe, citizen, law-abiding
well,
citizen,
maybe that's
needs to
the
do.
Reasonably related to what is probably what we're discussing.
Reasonably
to the
related.
Crime, to leading a law-abiding life, to being on the radar.
I think reasonably related to living like a normal law-abiding citizen is how I understand
Okay, in this case, what is there that is reasonably related? Why should this person have to be tested three times a week? Is that reasonably related to leading a law-abiding life, to the underlying crime here, or to registration?
Registration, no, I don't see how it would be. To leading a law-abiding life, well, if he is going out and getting drunk,
Does the record indicate that that's...
My recollection is no. I don't think there's anything specifically in the record that does. But again, the fact that the district court looked at what this person, Phillips, has done, or I think perhaps more importantly, has not done, and that's that he simply hasn't done anything. If you look at the whole...
Isn't the concern here that the district court may not have looked at the specific problems in this case? And should this court be putting its stamp of approval on blanket probation orders for everybody who gets into post-release supervision?
No, I don't think this court should put its stamp on blanket orders, but I think, again, it's committed to the discretion of the district court. If you look at what the district court was presented with, and that's a person who by the age of 23 had done exactly nothing to take care of himself, if you look at his pre-sentence investigation, he had never lived on his own. He said, there was no one to take care of me. I think that's a very telling statement. He didn't know what to do. Wasn't really sure what he wanted to do, and then somebody apparently stepped in and gave him a place to live, gave him food, put clothes on his back, and more importantly, got him a job, apparently. So he is, essentially, they were presented with an individual who is either incapable of or unwilling to take care of himself and live a quote-unquote normal life, and the court said, okay, based on what I'm seeing here, you need to grow up, son. And these are the conditions that I'm going to impose upon you to ensure that you live like an adult and that you don't get into trouble anymore. And I think that's not going to be imposed on everyone. It's simply not. I don't know that I've ever seen another case where everything that could be thrown at him was thrown at him. But under these circumstances, I think it was entirely appropriate given the nature and circumstances of this particular individual. Is there any specific evidence that he is out drinking and drugging? No. But I think you want to also impose upon him that that's not going to be acceptable as a normal adult living in the real world, which is really what we're trying to push them to towards being, is a citizen who at least, if not as being terribly productive, is at least not being a burden on the criminal justice system and on society as
Counsel,
a whole.
Counsel, does the statute allow modifications of post-supervision like a probation? In other words, if at some point they felt some of these provisions were not appropriate, couldn't they come in and ask the court to eliminate some of them?
I believe there is that provision that upon, you know, the court can do it on its own, the defendant can ask for it, or I think it seems like there's one other, but yeah, they can be modified. They can ultimately be modified. Your Honors, I'm almost out of time, but I think as you look at this case, on the whole, yes, there were a lot of terms and conditions imposed. They were all imposed, frankly. But based on this particular individual, the court felt it had no obligation, or it had no other alternative but to impose them all and try and make this, corral this guy, essentially, and make him act like a normal law-abiding citizen, because that's the entire thrust of the probation statutes and the post-release statutes, is to ensure that this person lives a law-abiding life and doesn't get into any additional trouble.
The language of the statute, the reasonably related to the rehabilitation of the offender, that language is only used in what we would call the catch-all clause, to impose, satisfy any other conditions. The language generally that controls what conditions are such reasonable conditions as it deems necessary or likely to ensure the offender will lead a law-abiding life. That's the focus of your argument. And it's important that we not conflate the two, isn't it?
I think so, yes. Yes. I think that language that you just read is the kind of the overarching thing to which the individual conditions apply. And if those individual conditions push the person towards the general direction of living a law-abiding life, then I think those conditions are reasonable.
And then if it's not one of the specified ones in the statute, if the judge is going to be creative and come up with something different, and I used to do that occasionally, it needs to be under subsection R, reasonably related to the rehabilitation of the offender. That's the control upon creativity
right.
of a trial judge.
Yes, I think that's exactly right.
All right, thank you.
We would ask then that the judgment of the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. The next case of the day is State versus Latricia L. Rogers.